What is truth? It's a question that Pilate asks Jesus. What is truth? What is truth in the face of the most powerful man this side of the emperor? Pilate was a Roman governor, and he was ruling over an occupied territory, which included Judea. Pilate didn't live in Jerusalem, but he had come to Jerusalem in anticipation of the Passover because he wanted to make sure things didn't get out of hand. You're thinking, well, Passover, like you go to your friend's house and have seders, why would anything get out of hand? Passover was and remains a celebration of liberation. Liberation of Israel from an occupying, or actually from at that time, a foreign power. And here they are once again, they're being ruled by a foreign power, and so the possibility for that getting a little bit, overexcited was of concern to Pilate. So what is truth in the face of the most powerful man this side of the governor? There was no, or this side of the emperor, there was no one outside of the emperor who was more powerful than he was. What is truth in the presence of a massive and very well-trained army? Rome occupied a lot of territory, and they had conquered it by force. Pilate had that force available to him. What is truth when one's own people have already determined what the outcome is going to be? You might remember when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, at that time the authorities said, he has to die. The only question is how and when. And the authorities needed Roman cooperation in order to make it happen because only Rome could crucify. And so just in case you're wondering, there's no illusion of an actual process going on here. Pilate says, well, why did you bring him to me? He says, well, you can kill him, we can't. They already knew what they wanted to do. And Pilate, the only legitimate reason for Rome to execute Jesus would have been had he shown himself to be a rebel. And by rebel, I don't mean like, you know, wearing your hat sideways inside the building, but by presenting himself as a competing power to Caesar. So Pilate's questions of, are you a king, are not just rhetorical. He really wants to know, are you a threat? Do I need to be concerned? And did you notice how deftly Jesus maneuvered that conversation? He never directly answered. And Pilate's not persuaded that Jesus has done anything wrong, let alone anything worthy of crucifixion. So he goes back out and he says to the authorities, you know, you have this custom during your festival that I would release a prisoner for you. How about I release Jesus for you? Figuring they'd say yes. They say, no, we don't want him. We want Barabbas. Barabbas means son of the Father. And we know that the true son of the true Father is there in front of Pilate, and yet they want the other son of another father. And just to make sure we get the point, the gospel writer ends this passage by saying, now Barabbas was a bandit. It was just a few weeks ago when Jesus was talking about being the good shepherd and differentiating between the hired hand and the good shepherd. And he also identifies that the good shepherd keeps the bandit from stealing the sheep. Jesus' own people choose the other son of the wrong father rather than the true son of the true father. And they choose the bandit over the good shepherd. Where's the truth in any of that? What does it matter? Pilate's question can be heard as being practical and it's most generous, probably a little cynical. And it's a question that could have been asked at any time, certainly in our own time. What is truth? We hear that question in classrooms. We hear that question in any kind of a blogging or online community. We hear that question anywhere there's public or political debate. What is truth? Not only what is true, but is what's the concept of truth? Is such a thing even possible? And in my lifetime, I've seen this answer change. Some of us grew up at a time when truth was understood to be objective, observable, repeatable. Think scientific method or the age of reason, right? Anyone grew up post-Enlightenment in the so-called modern era, that's how we understood truth. If you could observe it, if you could repeat it, if you could prove it by reason, true. Well, sometime 30, maybe more years ago in the arts world, and then moving into philosophy and academia, the answers began to change. Truth then became understood not as objective, but as subjective, as personal, as relative. And we hear it now in language when people say, well, you have to speak your truth. Yeah. Like, choose your flavor of ice cream. Yeah. And the answer for that, I mean, the prevailing wisdom of the world right now is that there is no absolute truth. Have you ever heard that said? There is no absolute truth. But if you listen to that, that asserts to be a statement of absolute truth. Right? So, folks don't like it when you point that out, by the way, but, you know, it's an argument that refutes itself. But regardless of whether it falls apart logically, it doesn't seem like we're all that interested in the truth. We don't pursue it. We prefer to hold to the ideology that we've already got. We only want to hear from people who agree with us. And we demonize those who don't. It's like we're living in ideological silos. After the 8 o'clock service, one of our members said, Pastor, MIT did this study on tweets. I'm sorry, it just sounds funny to say that word, you know. But so I do not have a Twitter account. You can't follow me there. But MIT studied and discovered that tweets that proved out to be false were retweeted more often than tweets that proved out to be true. Now, the skeptics among you might say, well, it's probably some MIT guy who told you that, so that's his truth. Do with it what you will. Just one more. We're just starting to learn about Generation Z, which is people ages 3 through 18, 19, thereabouts, you know, give or take on the high end. So the sub-millennial group. Those of us who are still trying to figure out millennials, now we got another generation. And this is, of course, our young people. Only 1/3 of young people believe lying to be morally wrong. So clearly an instrumental, higher purpose worldview where lying, what's the problem with that? And if just before you get too agitated with our young people, just realize they learned it from someone. Or they are learning it from someone. So if truth is not something we can agree on, not something we want to pursue, not something we even can agree exists, how do we inquire after anything? How do we talk with each other? How do we form agreements that have meaning and grip? I mean, it all sounds like a colossal waste of time. Why get out of bed in the morning? And I don't just mean on the mornings when we spring forward, but any morning at all. It's a bleak worldview. Unless, of course, Jesus is who he says he is. Jesus professes not only to speak the truth, but to be the truth. I am the way and the truth and the life. What if Jesus in his ministry, what if the signs that he does point to someone who transcends all things, who's timeless? I mean, Jesus' teaching is timeless. What if these forces that are conspiring to bring about Jesus' death actually accomplish that thing and do put him to death, and he's got an answer even for that? What if the question that Jesus asks Pilate, and it's really a question, when he says, "Those who belong to the truth, listen to my voice." He's asking, "Okay, Pilate, what's it going to be?" And when he says, "Listen to my voice," he doesn't mean hear and consider. He means listen, follow, embrace, embody, center around. What if that question for Pilate is a question for us too? Will we listen to him? Will we listen to him? It's worth considering. Jesus' words are worth considering because we see the world within a framework. And we view the world through a lens. Every one of us does. Even the deconstructionists view it through a broken frame and a cloudy lens. But we view through those things. And I believe that Jesus has accomplished things which would support his assertion that he is the truth. Jesus was bodily raised from death. This isn't just a statement of faith, it's an historic fact. And bodily raised from death, he transcends not only death, but the physicality, the limits of time and space that bind us yet today. There is no other human throughout all of history of whom that's true. That alone merits our listening to him. And Jesus, on the night before he died, promised his followers that he would send another one like him, the advocate, the spirit of, interestingly, truth, who we know as the Holy Spirit, to come alongside them, to be with them. And that, you know, little band of 12 timid, sometimes friends, has become a force across history, 2 billion or more today, transcendent of culture and age and economics and race and everything. Jesus is the most universally accepted person in all of history. That alone ought to merit our listening to him. Tim Keller is a pastor and writer, and he writes books primarily with an audience in mind that is struggling with how to put together faith and reason. And he often finds himself taking on the argument that faith by itself is unreasonable and therefore doesn't even belong in the conversation. In the marketplace of ideas, faith doesn't have a stall. And so Keller wrote a book some years ago. It was his first New York Times bestseller called The Reason for God. Some of you have read it, I know. And in it, it's a It's kind of a classic apologetics, but written with a contemporary slant. And what are the objections to Christianity, and what are the benefits of Christianity? And he puts really tight arguments out there and invites people to read and consider. But in between the writing of that book and more recently, Keller found himself more and more in conversation with folks who just refused to acknowledge that it was a level playing field. And so he wrote another book called Making Sense of God, which it's like a prequel to The Reason for God. Now, I have to tell you, this is a very, very compelling book. And it's also a bit of a heavy lift, especially on the front end when he's dealing a lot with philosophical categories. And it's worth the read if you can get through that. But if you find yourself, like, you know, checking out in that part, it's your book. You can do with it what you want. Skip that. Because his practical arguments, I think, are compelling on their own. So these are some of the things that Keller describes that Jesus offers us. A meaning that suffering can't take from you. A satisfaction that is not based on circumstances. This is my favorite. An identity that doesn't crush you or exclude others. A hope that can face anything. A justice that doesn't create new oppressors. Now, if you're thinking, Pastor Don, you are moving way too fast. Those are really dense topics. You're right. I think each one is worth its own sermon. Then you're not going to hear those today. But today, I put those forward as support for Jesus' assertion that, in fact, he is the truth. I'll end with something more personal. This weekend will be for me, in fact, it already is, one of the fastest moving, most all over the place, demanding weekends of my life as a pastor. Friday, I spent half a day meeting with a candidate to join our pastoral staff. And then Saturday morning, sat in with our call committee and our board president as they interviewed the same candidate. Then yesterday afternoon, I presided at a funeral. Yesterday, later in the afternoon, I was invited here to meet with our young families and talk about Easter. And did Kate leave? I'll say this. So, like, you know, you don't want the bad slot sometimes. The bad slot is when someone says, Pastor's going to talk to you about Easter now, and then you can go gather up the eggs. You don't want that slot. Last night, I led the prayer at a benefit, a foundation benefit, a fundraiser for a ministry that's very, very near and dear to many of us for a long time. And this morning, we're hanging out here. And after lunch, I'm going to meet with a young couple who's preparing for marriage and for whom faith is very, very important. And I'm going to end it tonight by standing side by side with a Baptist pastor and teaching confirmation to a room full of Roman Catholic high school students. It's mind-bending, isn't it? And as I was leaning into this weekend, and even in the middle of it, just the whole how, what's big enough to hold all of that together? Because it's not just like you got appointments and you go and do one appointment. You know, I had to not just show up, but be present and responsive and fully engaged. And Friends, there's only one reality that can hold all of that. And it's this. God is love. God is love and is most perfectly seen and understood and known through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. What is truth? His name is Jesus. Amen.